BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and I'm joined this week by Conservative councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as usual, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, who are the Tea Party? We discuss the US elections as well as hear calls for a radical shake-up of the banking system by none other than city regulator Mervyn King, Governor of the Bank of England. And we hear from the wife of a colonel in the US Marine Corps that Muslim terrorists may not be all they seem. Also, an increasing number of parents and children are choosing to be educated at home in Bristol, despite scare stories that it's illegal. We ask, does home education really provide a viable alternative to regular schools? That's in the second hour. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, continuing cold and drizzly. This weekend, highs of 10 degrees Celsius in the daytime, a fairly dry weekend, but feeling cooler, especially on Sunday. Some sunny spells. Next week, highs a little up on the temperatures at the moment, up to 13 degrees Celsius, cooler though at the beginning of the week, and fairly cloudy and wet right through the week. Next weekend, that's the 13th and 14th of November, we have highs down again to 10 degrees Celsius, fairly dry and sunny, but possibly windy next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now. And with me is Conservative councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Hi, Chris.
Hi there.
Now, first of all, Chris, you're a Conservative councillor. What drew you to the Conservative Party to rather than one of the other parties?
Well, probably my answer will get me thrown out of all the parties now. But like everybody else, I don't agree with everything that any of the parties say. So I had to look at it from a pragmatic point of view and say, which one do I disagree with least? And I disagreed least with the Conservatives. But it doesn't mean to say that I just follow the party line on everything. And I'll probably be out next week now.
But do you think you have sympathy for voters who sometimes feel the same, that actually it's the lesser of two, three or four evils?
Yes, I can appreciate how they feel because, surprisingly enough, I'm actually a voter as well. I know people do feel very confused sometimes. People on the doorstep sometimes put across the view, well, you're all the same, it's not worth voting for you. And I do try and make the point that even if they register a negative vote by spoiling their paper or voting for everybody, at least they should exercise their right to turn up and do something and actually have the vote, because a lot of people have spent many, many years and an awful lot of difficulties in getting the vote for everybody. And just as a thank you to them, we should get off our backsides and go along and vote.
Do you think the Conservative Party is a democratic party? Do you think that David Cameron and his policies fairly represent what the wider Conservative membership want?
Yes, I think they do. Obviously, there will be shades of opinion, both in the party and in the opposition to the party. There will be shades of opinion. But by and large, I would say, yes, David Cameron is a fairly fair person, and I think the party has followed his line.
OK. Now, what's your portfolio on the council? What committees do you sit on?
Oh, dear. I go home probably at Christmas, and the rest of the time I seem to spend my time in the council house. But basically, I'm on central planning. I'm on community cohesion and public safety, which is a scrutiny commission, and I'm on health and community adult care scrutiny commission.
So what are these scrutiny commissions? Do they just, the idea is that they look at other committees and scrutinise what they do?
No, basically they look at decisions that are being made by the cabinet and council policy, and if they're unhappy with that, they can call in decisions, and then it's basically down to the cabinet whether they accept criticism or whether they decide to ignore it. Can I just say publicly that I am not in favour of the present system of cabinet-style government. I think it was a bad thing introduced some years ago. It was a government decision. I think it's bad. I don't think it helps democracy at all. And I think really, in a way, it's a very big imposition to have eight councillors making decisions for the city. It's an awful lot of responsibility. I'd like to see it go back to the old system of committees where all the councillors get an opportunity to take part in the decision and take the responsibility.
So why is that? Why do you think that? Do you think decisions are being made incorrectly by the cabinet, whereas they would be better made by the whole council?
Well, I just feel that it somehow it disenfranchises those people who are represented by councillors who are not involved in that decision making process.
Do you feel like some councillors on some of the big decisions of the city then feel like they're banging their heads against a brick wall?
Yeah, I think very often there's a feeling that you're in a position where you can do nothing. You're expected to do nothing. You're tarred with the brush of whatever it is that people don't agree with. But in actual fact, your hands are tied.
Couldn't you say the same for Westminster, though? You know, surely decisions could be made by the full House of Commons on each decision rather than a cabinet up at Westminster.
Now look, I get in enough trouble in Bristol and I get involved in Westminster.
Okay, well, Martin Summers is joining us too. Martin, you're our old Labour Oxford economist. Can you just give us an idea of your thoughts on today's story where George Osborne, the Chancellor, has been saying that he is prepared now to print more money if the recovery falters? I thought he'd told us that we were out of the trees now and that recovery was going to happen.
Well, obviously, nobody can say that we're out of the woods yet, by any stretch of the imagination. I think a bigger story is that the US is definitely going to go for quantitative easing. I was reading an article about this yesterday, and they were saying it's like having brain surgery when you've actually got a bottle of aspirins for your headache. It's a monetarist trick, this idea of printing money to try and keep the banks afloat. I'm not so sure that it's actually such a good idea. I mean, the Americans are actually annoying other countries by doing this because it forces the dollar down and messes up other people's currency strategies.
Yes, but they're just going to run out of money if they don't do it, aren't they? You can't blame them.
No, well, what they should do is a proper fiscal stimulus, which actually means spending money into the economy and giving it to poor people to spend rather than giving it to the banks to try and keep the interest rate low. But they're not prepared to do that, and I think that what's happened in the elections in the US this week with the Republican right being resurgent in Congress is that Obama is now unable to move or do anything that he really wants to do. So that's actually quite bad news for the world if we've got gridlock in the US, because they're the bit, you know, what happens in the US affects everybody.
Well, on Wednesday, the Press Association was saying that US policymakers have announced further emergency measures to prop up the recovery of the world's biggest economy. The Federal Reserve said it would pump an extra $600 billion, that's around about £400 billion, into its economy over the next 8 months, the second round of quantitative easing. And now George Osborne is saying he may well have to do the same for Britain. Is that the right thing to do for Britain? You don't seem to think it's right for America.
No,
what
they should be doing, in my view, is having a fiscal reflationary policy. And Conservative governments in the 1950s would have understood exactly what I was talking about. It's not necessarily a party political issue.
But Alistair Darling, your former Chancellor, did exactly this, didn't he? So why was it wrong then
I think the problem is that when the banking system collapsed in 2008... We're in a new world, but people are still thinking in the old way. And Labour, of course, having been in power for 13 years and presided over the kind of deregulation of the city and all the rest of it, we're not in a strong position to argue for the kind of policies that will be necessary before we get out of this, in my view. But I think, as I've said before on this programme, Conservative governments in the past were more pragmatic. And we're able to approach this in a more pragmatic way than currently seems to be the case.
Well, let me ask you about this, Conservative councillor, Chris Windows. George Osborne is now saying, we may have to print more money if the recovery falters. Now, I thought, as part of the comprehensive spending review a few weeks ago, we were being told that we were out of the doldrums now and that there was going to be a recovery. So he now seems to be changing his tune.
Well, George hasn't actually phoned me and told me this himself, so to a degree we're reliant upon the media to get this information.
What are you saying? He does? He's not considering printing money?
No, I'm saying he hasn't discussed it with me. However, To go on to the subject itself, quantitative easing, in my book, really is another word for devaluation, because the more money you print, the less value each particular item is worth. So in a way, it's devaluation. It's the same as back a long time ago when Harold Wilson said that the devaluation wouldn't affect the pound in your pocket. It's going to affect the pound in your pocket.
Yeah, I think the problem is that they've got this G20 summit coming up in South Korea, and it's shaping up like the gunfight at the OK Corral, because the US quantitative easing basically means that the US is printing money and forcing the dollar down, and other countries don't want their currencies. We're getting competitive devaluation now. So everybody is trying to beggar thy neighbour by printing money and forcing their currency down. Now, that can't work. Inevitably, that is going to lead to conflict. And we may see the world breaking up into trade blocks, trade wars, real wars. And this is a very dangerous moment for that reason.
Chris, what's going on up in Westminster? I really do need to know, because we're hearing all the same sort of stuff as was heard under Labour that David Cameron was complaining about in the run-up to the general election. Royal Bank of Scotland now are back in the red. That's the bank that we own, with $1.4 billion loss, we hear today. But the taxpayers are still forking out for massive bonuses. They received a £20 billion, this is RBS, taxpayer-funded bailout in October 2 years ago, and the chairman, Sir Philip Hampton, repeatedly vowed to limit bonuses, but we see now that the bonuses are happening again. So why has David Cameron not done what he said he'd do before the general election?
I think there are two problems here. I think the first problem is that we need to be sensible and realise that although governments and large governments such as the government of the US think they control the money markets, in actual fact, it's the bankers and the mercantile banks that actually control stuff and how it flows around the world.
So at what point is the government going to actually intervene and say, actually, well, we need to take a hand here?
Well, I don't know. There again, I haven't actually spoken to George on this. I'm giving him my advice. But I don't know. They need to do something, because an awful lot of people feel, and I sympathise with them and feel very much the same way, that we've been seen off by the banks. It's not the first time I've been seen off by the bank, and I'm sure others can sympathise with that. But I really do feel that the government needs to speak to other governments, because it needs to be a concerted effort to try and control the way the cash goes around the world and it doesn't end up in the right places.
Well, the other big bank that we own now is Lloyds, and they're under fire yesterday, in The Guardian anyway, over the new Lloyds chief's £8 million pay deal. Apparently, this is Lloyds Banking Group, which was under pressure to publish the details of an £8 million a year pay deal for its new chief executive, Antonio Horta Osorio, who is apparently Portuguese, after the Liberal Democrats demanded figures on the lending targets and other criteria attached to the controversial package. Now, apparently, they're trying to twist his arm to get him to lend to small businesses. And not only that, his daughter apparently has been appointed the head of Santander UK. So would you think that George Osborne and David Cameron are really doing what they should be doing with these banks that we, the people, now own?
I suspect, and it's only a suspicion, but I suspect that they're, David Cameron's approach and George Osborne's approach is a softly, softly catchy monkey at the moment. Let's face it, they've only been in 6 months. There are some decisions and actions that you can take that are irreversible. They don't want to get us in a bigger mess than we're already in, but I suspect that there are nooses being prepared.
Yeah, I think the problem, I think Chris has identified the problem. The banks have enormous political power, and it's very difficult for anybody to discipline them, whoever they are, whoever the government is. And in the US, it's even more apparent, because the banks or the hedge funds basically fund the political process. So they get bailed out. All the banks are claiming that they're making profits, apart from a couple of losses that, you know, we've seen losses for RBS. But of course, that's all based on this mark to fantasy. You know, if they actually looked at their assets and actually had to flog them off, they'd all be insolvent. And the banking system is insolvent.
So does anybody actually audit these accounts? Because if you're saying that the accounts, what it says on their books, doesn't actually match up with what they did is that they
got an agreement that they would not have to mark their assets to market. Yeah, so they can basically say they can make their assets what they want them to be. Ideally, this piece of paper is worth X. But if they had to sell it in the market, it would be worth a lot less than that. But they don't actually sell it. They just sit on it and say it's worth X, and that becomes their assets, which then allows them to make profits, which pays bonuses. But all the banks are actually in loss.
Isn't that a fraud?
It is fraud. There's an awful lot of fraud going on here. In the savings and loans scandal in the 1980s, up to 1,500 bank executives in the United States were sent to prison. So far, nobody has been sent to prison in this debacle that we're going through. And that is because, basically, the banks have got themselves, and the hedge funds have got themselves in a position where they are above the law. And, of course, if the economy picks up, and we go back to some kind of normality, then everybody will forget about this. But if, as I suspect, we're about to go through the second leg of the crisis and the crash, people are going to get very, very angry all over the world. People are going to get furious with this situation.
Now, Chris, is it really good enough to play slowly, slowly catchy monkey with the fraudsters?
Well, I would hesitate to use that particular word because I have a great deal of respect for our legal system in this country. I would say that before you take any action, that you make sure you're taking the right action and an effective action, because you're dealing with people who are very, very clever, very, very clever, and you make the wrong move and you just dig yourself a deeper pit.
Well,
and
of course, Goldman Sachs, a big investment bank, is being prosecuted for fraud as we speak.
Yes. Well, good job. So they should be. If you or I were to do anything on a fraction of that scale, they'd lock us up and throw away the key.
But the problem with all of this is, of course, that for a lot of these massive investment banks, they think, well, what's the worst that could happen? Well, we're going to get a fine.
Well, actually, that's the problem. You see, they get fined, but the fine is actually less than what they've actually defrauded, so it's not really a deterrent. I mean, one of the things that they did in the savings and loans scandal in the 1980s is they said, if we detect fraud for X, we're going to fine you three times whatever the fraud is. So there's a real deterrent in there. But of course, that's all been rolled back.
Well, yeah. According to the Washington Post, though, there is light at the end of the tunnel. War with Iran would rescue the economy. Washington Post political correspondent David Broder this week has kind words for President Barack Obama in his opinion column on last Sunday, arguing that it isn't the president's fault that the economy is stuck in reverse, but the four-decade-plus veteran of Washington politics offers a startling solution to the president's political and economic woes. March off to war with Iran. That will solve your economic crisis. Martin, can you just explain, why is it that a war, which obviously would cost a fantastic amount of money, could actually be good for the US economy?
Well, I think it's harking back to the whole thing in the Second World War, when there was a decade of depression, and then when America geared up to fight the Second World War, they managed to reflate their economy and put everybody to work or into uniform or whatever. I think the reason is that war... if you've got a war, you can turn around and say, right, we're going to print money, or we're going to raise taxes, or we're going to do what we've got to do because there's a war on, and therefore you can do it. In peacetime, governments feel unable to demand those kind of policies from the population.
So you're saying that it sort of just concentrates the politicians' minds a bit?
I think so. I mean, frankly, they ought to be able to do what's necessary without having a war. I mean, that's what I would argue, is that they should think about, you know, it's an emergency, but a war is not the answer.
And what's your thoughts about this column in the Washington Post last weekend, Chris?
Well, I think as far as it goes, it's a bit like a curate's egg. Of course, it's good in parts. When there's a war, it definitely creates work. Conscripts don't get paid all that much, and there's lots of them, and they can't argue. But you have to look at the bigger picture. And I mean, if you can imagine what it was like here post 1945. It was dreadful. I mean, we had all sorts of difficulties. And we're not far away from it now, actually. But, yes, it does create work. But once the war finishes, and sooner or later the war will finish, then you've got to pay for the cost. And it's always the... citizens that end up paying the cost of any of these things.
Do you think that the fact that we've got this long running war in Afghanistan, particularly, I mean, obviously there was the Iraq war too, but that has lasted longer than the Second World War, and obviously is much further away from home, that has actually contributed to the financial crisis?
Well, as we've just heard, it costs money to fight a war, a lot of money. Governments don't have any money of their own. It's our money that they're spending for us. So at the end of the day, any war costs us an awful lot of money. And it's not just the money that it costs. It's the terrible destruction of the lives on all sides. There's got to be a better way to sort out problems than fighting.
Martin, would you draw a direct connection between the financial crisis and the war spending?
I think you can. I mean, you know, the deficit in the US, really, they took the dollar off gold in 1972 because they didn't want to, in order to pay for the Vietnam War. So, and that, of course, is when the US economy started to get into trouble. Big trade deficits, budget deficits ballooning, and it's really imperial overstretch. If you were to take out, you know, the Vietnam War and all the other wars that the US has fought since 1972, then they'd probably be in a much better fiscal position than they are now. I'm afraid that we're moving into a sort of territory now where, you know, where it's crazy, where people are pushing. I mean, if you're going to have a war with Iran, I don't think we should have a war with Iran, by the way, but if you're going to have a war, it should be based on the idea of, you know, some political objective. I mean, I think it's absolutely outrageous to suggest that you're going to solve your economic problems by making war on another country.
But if you control Iran and their oil fields, isn't that going to help underpin
the US economy? That's what they thought about Iraq as well. Iraq was going to pay for itself. It was going to be a cakewalk. It was going to be over in 3 weeks, and it was going to pay for itself because the Iraqi oil would be so profitable that it would pay for the war.
And
that hasn't worked.
Now we've just seen something like 2 weeks of the highest number of killings and explosions and deaths there's ever been in Iraq.
Well, that's right. I mean, of course, it's gone off the front pages now. But I mean, as Chris was saying, you know, war can seem like, I mean, they used to use a phrase about the US that it was a military Keynesian economy. Now, Keynes was an economist who used to believe in spending to try and get out of slumps. But I mean, in the US, the only legitimate government spending, which everybody can agree on, is war spending. If you were to spend money, I mean, you can see that the Tea Party people who've just got to power in the US, in the Congress, are about to roll back Obama's healthcare reform. That's their number one priority, is to stop the government spending money on healthcare. It's a pretty silly reform anyway. I'm not really that keen on what he's done. But I mean, the fact is that they don't want to spend money on healthcare, but they can agree to spend money on war, and because that's the only thing they can agree to spend money on, that's the only way you can reflate the economy. But that's very dangerous for the world if we're all dependent on US and British military spending to keep ourselves in work. Then that's a very dangerous thing, isn't it?
Well, talking about the war on terror, this time last week all eyes were focused on East Midlands Airport, and at Prime Minister's questions this week, Labour opposition leader Ed Miliband chose to quiz Conservative leader David Cameron about the alleged toner cartridge bomb plot. The device was allegedly posted in Yemen and then detected at East Midlands Airport.
Ed Miliband, can I thank the Prime Minister for that answer? And can I take the opportunity to ask him about the wider context to this incident? Does he agree with me that as well as the right measures on counter-terrorism, we need to tackle its roots as well? He will know that Yemen has long been one of the poorest countries in the Middle East, and that is why the Friends of Yemen conference was held earlier this year and one is organised for next February. Can he update the House on the process of those talks, the Friends of Yemen talks, and also progress with the crucial IMF plan for Yemen to deliver much needed economic reform?
What the Right Honourable says is absolutely right, that as well as having good intelligence sharing, as well as having tough terrorism, anti-terrorism legislation in place, as well as those things, we have to deal with the root causes, and there is now a very worrying strain of Al-Qaeda terrorism coming out of the Yemen. One of the problems is we need to make sure it is the priority for the Yemeni government, who are also dealing with other problems in their country. The Friends of Yemen process, which the former Prime Minister did a great deal to establish, is up and running, it is working well. The British are co-chairs of it with the Saudis. There was a meeting at the UN General Assembly. There'll be further meetings. And the whole aim is to try and pressurise and work with the Yemeni government to deal with the issues that affect the wider region and indeed, as the recent events showed, affect us too. We'll go on with that. We will go on, as we've committed with our development budget, to make sure development aid is going to the Yemen. So there's, if you like, a short-term issue of getting the Yemeni government to concentrate on what matters, and there's a longer-term issue about economic development in the Yemen, which badly needs to improve.
Ed Miliband.
Can I thank the Prime Minister for that answer? And can I thank him and the Home Secretary for keeping the House updated on these issues? And I know that they will continue to do so.
Well, it wasn't exactly Rottweiler-style questioning on the East Midlands attack from Ed Miliband there, the Labour leader. But Martin, what about Yemen? Why is it that Yemen is suddenly, you know, we've had Iraq, we've had Afghanistan, now all eyes are on Yemen. Why might that be?
Well, I mean, it's another part of the global jigsaw, isn't it? I mean, Yemen and Somalia are very strategically placed countries. And there's a great deal of interest in controlling
they're
what
actually,
goes on there.
They're actually very close, aren't they? And there's that.
Well, they control the Horn of Africa between them.
That's right. What are your thoughts about this terror scare then this week? Because we've had some very challenging journalism from people like Peter Mackay in the Daily Mail, which is he's saying another day, another war against terror scare. This time it's printer cartridges rigged up as bombs sent as air cargo from the Yemen to Chicago via refueling stops where the devices were found. The result, alarming media coverage, politicians warning the war on terror is ongoing and we must never drop our guard. Here we go again.
Well, I mean, the stuff I've been reading about this suggests that in actual fact there was no bomb, that it wasn't a viable device. But I just don't know. When you hear stories like this, which are to do with intelligence and terrorism and so on, you've just got to have a great big pinch of salt, because you just don't know what's really going on here. You're not really. I mean, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a supposedly set up organisation set up a couple of years ago with two guys who were actually Guantanamo detainees and were released and went back to Yemen to set this organisation up just in time for the underpants bomber last Christmas to be run out of Yemen, supposedly. Although we've got evidence from people who were on the plane with the underpants bomber that he went onto the plane without going through a security check. Now, I don't know what's going on here. I suspect a lot more than we know, a lot more than we're aware of, and we've just got to keep our nerve about all of this and take it all with a big pinch of salt.
Well, I think that's quite right, but there's something that we should take into account. I mean, this is a personal observation and a personal belief that every government needs to control the population. And one of the best ways of controlling the population is to have something which the population can be made to fear and something which the government is going to protect them from, provided people follow the rules.
Well, there's been a couple of bizarre things about this latest terror scare with these freight planes and these UPS parcels. One is that the local police in Leicestershire had actually given the all clear, saying there were no explosives and no bombs for about 6 hours last Friday, before then there was an announcement made by the White House that, yes, these were viable devices, and of course the security cordons went up again. And also that the woman who was supposed to have posted these in the Yemen and was arrested for it, it turns out wasn't the person that actually posted them at all.
Yes, and there was questions whether it was a UPS or a Federal Express parcel or whatever. I mean, it's a cynical thing to say, but this may have an awful lot to do with the midterm elections in the United States. That may be an explanation behind what's going on here. We just don't know.
What do you mean? What could it have to do with?
Well, I mean, as Christmas hinting there, governments like to have control over things, and then if incidents happen, which happen, which creates the sort of atmosphere that you want, then you can. I mean, we just don't know, do we? I think Theresa May has made a statement recently that we've got to get the balance between terrorism and civil liberties better than it has been. And I think that I look to the coalition government to take a rational view on all of these things, and not to we shouldn't give in to fear. People are dying every day in these wars, and we're already in up to our necks, but we mustn't get into a panicky state about any of these things. We've got to be very calm about everything.
But surely, in the situation last Friday where the local police gave the all clear and then suddenly the security services would have come in and the whole story changed. Surely the security services are the people that know what they're doing, not the little local cops.
No, I would suggest that we need to have police primacy in all of these matters, because this is intelligence services, quite frankly, are suspects in many of these cases. They are. And that's why we need police primacy.
Okay, well, you mentioned the US elections there, Martin, and the midterm elections were held in the US this week with one of the Republican candidates for Delaware, or with the Republican candidate for Delaware, that's Christine O'Donnell, famously issuing a bizarre TV ad denying that she was a witch and declaring that, quote, I Am You. Well, US comedy show Saturday Night Live decided to do their own version of her TV ad.
Hi, I'm Christine O'Donnell, and I'm not a witch. I'm nothing like you've heard. I'm you. And just like you, I have to constantly deny that I'm a witch. Isn't that what the people of Delaware deserve? A candidate who promises, first and foremost, that she's not a witch? That's the kind of candidate Delaware hasn't had since 1692. And that's why, if elected to the Human Senate, I promise to fly straight down to Washington on a plane and do exactly what you would do, not spells. Besides, if I were a witch, why wouldn't I just cast a spell making all of you forget that I'm a witch? It's certainly not because the spell requires one newt per person, and I lack a sufficient number of newts. I know the problems facing our nation, because I've been living among you since I moved to Delaware from the Black Forest of Germany almost 3,000 years ago. So this November 2nd, vote for Christine O'Donnell, a.k.a. Zoraida the Enchantress, because I'm not a witch, and if I am, do you really want to cross me? I didn't think so.
Paid for by the coven to elect Christine O'Donnell, who is not a witch.
That was an excerpt from the US comedy show Saturday Night Live there, parodying Christine O'Donnell for Delaware Republican candidate. And actually, she lost in Delaware. But on a more serious note, Martin, maybe you can start us off on this. What does it mean now that the Republicans have got the whip hand over in US politics? And where does it put Barack Obama, who's
a
Democrat president?
I think the bizarre thing about US politics, which people don't realise, is if you're trying to get anything through the Congress and the Senate, you have to have two-thirds majority. So it basically creates permanent gridlock. I mean, now that the Congress is in the hands of the Republicans, Obama's going to find it very difficult to put forward his programme. But he was finding it difficult anyway, because he has to have a two-thirds majority in both the Senate and the Congress to get anything through. So the gridlock is just about built into the US system, and that's rather worrying for the rest of the world, because basically what they do affects us enormously, and if they can't get their act together, then we're all going to be in a lot of trouble.
Well, we've seen a similar, possibly a problem in Iraq, hasn't it, who haven't actually managed to form a proper government for several months.
Obviously, Iraq's in a difficult situation, but I mean, what happens in Iraq doesn't have the impact on the rest of the world that the US has. I mean, the US basically is the biggest player on the planet, and if they can't get their act together, it creates all sorts of problems for everybody.
So if the US government isn't really able to function properly, who makes the decisions in America then?
Well, we went to the bankers earlier, weren't we?
Anyway, Chris, yes. What are your thoughts on the results of the US midterm elections?
Not that surprising, really, considering the difficulty that Barack Obama has already encountered with some of the policies that he's wanted to introduce.
Do you think it's his own fault for trying to bring in stuff that is just not going to work?
I'm not going to slate anybody for wanting to do what they think is right. But whether I could support him is a different matter. I admire his spirit, but I have to suspect his success.
Do you think that actually that the US president is not all they're cracked up to be? I mean, they're supposed to be the guy at the top, aren't they? Do you think he's really the man at the top in America right now?
I don't think any man who is the figurehead, and that's what he is, I don't think any man could possibly, particularly with a country as big and complex as the United States, could be said to be totally in charge. He's got to rely on an awful lot of people that are supporting him, and some of them will make the decisions for him. He can't make all the decisions, and he may very well not have been as well advised as he could have been. We just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the things that's quite noticeable is that General Petraeus in Afghanistan has basically been contradicting his commander-in-chief, that is Barack Obama. Barack Obama saying, we're going to get out by such and such a date, and Petraeus is saying, no, we're not. And of course, Petraeus has got political ambitions. He's a Republican, as is Ben Bernanke, who runs the Federal Reserve, and he wants to run for president in 2012. So you've got a situation where the emperor is saying one thing and one of his generals is saying something else. Meanwhile, the empire is actually crumbling. So a lot of this looks rather like the you know, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And that's not rather, you know, that's not a very comforting analogy, really. We're living in dangerous times.
And we'll be talking a little bit more about the US elections and the fallout from that after the 6 o'clock news. Now, members of the National Union of Journalists are on strike today and tomorrow over proposed changes to their pension scheme, saying the management intend to rob the pension pot of their savings. I went down to the picket line on White Ladies Road earlier and asked Points West journalist Steve Brodie why BBC journalists had decided to strike today.
Yeah, I'm Steve Brodie. I'm the BBC Points West Home Affairs correspondent, and I'm a member of the NUJ. Well, it's about, fundamentally, the decision by the BBC to change its pension plan. People who've been in the BBC a long time, like myself, have been saving for a long time. And the BBC decided to take a look at its pension and replace the existing schemes with two or three schemes which are singularly less favourable to the workforce.
Why is it that you feel that public sector workers at the BBC are somehow different and should be protected from some of the effects of the financial crisis?
I don't think we're different in any way at all. The average pension in the BBC is £12,000 compared with the £1 million pension pots of the top management in London. I have to emphasise that most of the people who work for the BBC are here because they want to. A lot of people joined the BBC many years ago because the pay itself is not particularly high, apart from the great stars, as it were. But people joined it because it had a reasonable pension fund, of which, we contributed to. So therefore, one is saying that it is a robbery because we have contributed to a pension fund over a number of years, and now it's been taken away from us. On the point, why should we be different? Well, I don't think we should be different. For instance, the average pension in the National Health Service is only £5,000 or £6,000, which in itself is an appalling state of affairs. How could possibly somebody live on £5,000 or £6,000 a year? I don't think David Cameron could, or indeed any of the top Labour Party shadow cabinet. They couldn't live on that either. This is not a political action in any way whatsoever. We all have completely different political views. It's an action to prevent what we see as theft. And I have to say that the BBC said, well, the pension pot has gone down because of the fall of the markets, which is absolutely true. It's now gone up again as the markets have gone up. So the argument that, well, we can't afford it doesn't really stand up to close analysis.
The other broadcasting unions, Bechtu and Unite, who have some members at the BBC, have actually accepted a deal with the BBC. So why hasn't the National Union of Journalists accepted the deal?
Well, because we think we can get a better offer. After all, we had discussions and we had a strike ballot, which 9 out of 10 members of the NUJ voted in favour of a strike. 9 out of 10, an extraordinary ratio in any ballot for a strike. And that, I think, ignited the discussion, the debate inside the BBC, which resulted in an improved offer from the DG Mark Thompson, a considerably better offer than his proposals. So I think the logic is that if you push more, then you get more. We're not asking for the world. In fact, we're very well aware, most of us, if not all of us, are deeply committed to public service broadcasting. I've worked in other places before I joined the BBC, and I know the value of it. There's no greater supporter of the BBC than myself. I think it's an appalling state of affairs when it's under threat, and it is under threat. And I want to defend the institution. At the same time, I think the people who have contributed over a number of years should get the benefits that they have actually accrued.
Points West's Home Affairs correspondent Steve Brodie there talking to me earlier today outside the BBC Broadcasting House in White Ladies Road here in Bristol. Now, Chris, what is going on here? Because as many people are very, very concerned about their pensions. We were told when these private pensions were introduced probably 20 years or so ago to begin with, that there would be... This would be a copper-bottomed cast iron that you would be able to get all of the money that you were. And the problem here is that the employers are not contributing the same amount as the employees. The employees have kept their side of the bargain and the employers haven't.
Well, first of all, I'd say that I can remember, having been in business myself, I can remember going to a meeting, a big meeting at West Bromwich. in probably about 1977, 78, where the pensions crisis, or the looming crisis, was discussed then. There were lots of proposals put forward. The government of the time didn't do anything about it, and governments since haven't done anything about it. And we're in a situation now where people have been promised more than is available. Now, it's a bad state of affairs. But then I'd like you to look at my own personal position. I invested in a building where I ran one of my businesses, a lot of money, my own personal money, and in the last recession, ended up having to sell that property in order to ensure that I paid my creditors. That was to be my pension. I lost that. There's nobody that I can blame, really, not even myself. I did all the right things. It was just bad luck, and it was just against me. Now, there might be a banker somewhere in the Lebanon that is to blame for it, but I haven't found out his name yet. And I doubt very much if I get much redress if I did find somebody to blame. And I really think that a lot of people are in that position. Life is not the fairest or nicest of things most of the time.
In this particular case with the BBC strike, the BBC themselves took a two-year pensions holiday. In other words, the BBC were not contributing their half into the pension fund for 2 years. And now they've decided that even though they thought that this was going to be okay, it isn't. So do you think the BBC should cough up?
Yes, I do. I think that's wrong, what they've done.
Well, I think I would agree with that, absolutely. Don't forget that these are contracts that people have entered into. Many people working in the public sector often accept lower wages and salaries than they would get in comparable private sector employment. And they do it because they've got more security of employment, and they hope that their pensions will be secure. You know, as people leave university and decide what they're going to do, some people decide to take a more risky path. They go into business. And of course, the rewards are bigger, but the risks are bigger. And that's a choice that people make. Other people play safer. They want to go into a big institution like the BBC or the NHS, and they don't expect to make big bucks, but they do expect security. And these are contracts. I mean, we had people from the PCS in here the other week and making the point that these are contracts that you sign, when the contract of employment that says, you know, the employer and employee have responsibilities which are legally enforceable.
But the BBC have the right to renegotiate that contract, don't they?
Not necessarily, no. Those contracts are existing contracts. I mean, and there was a legal decision about this not long ago, because PCS took the government to court when they tried to cut the pensions entitlement, and the court said,
"This is the civil servants."
Yeah, they just said, "The court said, look, these are contracts, the legal contracts. You can't just rip them up and renegotiate them." And that's what the legal position is, and that's why people are defending their position. I mean, that's what they're going to, aren't they?
Yeah, I think we should recognise the fact that renegotiating means getting both sides to agree, not taking a unilateral decision and forcing it on the other party.
Well, it sounds like you're supporting the strike there, Chris. Anyway, moving on to a local story now. Bristol City's chairman has delivered a verdict on £11.8 million loss Bristol City Football Club were today counting the cost of Championship football. Asked, this is actually yesterday's Evening Post saying this, record losses of £11.8 million for the last financial year. Chairman Steve Lansdowne insisted the latest loss is sustainable, but admitted the club's current balance sheet is a mess. Bristol City Football Club lost £11 million, nearly £12 million during the year ended 31st of May 2010. That's almost double the then record shortfall of £6.5 million 12 months earlier. Now, the majority of the club's debt is owed to Stephen Lansdowne personally, and while he remains at the helm, losses on such a scale will no doubt be sustainable. But the chairman today warned that costs must be cut if City are to return to profitability in the future. And as we heard on Points West yesterday, before the strike, actually, Stephen Lansdowne is actually now even potentially threatening to leave Bristol City if he doesn't get his way over this planning permission. So, Martin, do you want to start by explaining, or maybe by just detailing, what you think about this, the fact that the Bristol City Football Club is in such a horrendous financial position, it seems?
Well, there's not a lot to say about it, is there, really? This is kind of news to me. They're in a horrendous financial position. It probably, from the point of view of people living in the city, the big question in people's minds is what's going to happen about this new stadium? Is it going to go ahead? Is
well, it
not going to go ahead? What's happening?
If they don't get the stadium deal, then it looks like the club may go down the tubes.
Well, I mean, that's obviously something of concern not just to Bristol City fans, but also to the city as a whole. Because, of course, with the World Cup coming up, having a world-class stadium in Bristol, there's a broad consensus that that's what the city wants, because we want some of those games to come here. And if this all falls through as a result of this, then that's obviously put in jeopardy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. But I think also we must realise that the football clubs really are businesses. First and foremost, they are businesses. They're run as businesses. They suffer all the risks any business will suffer. If they're undercapitalised, that in itself is a big risk at any time. A lot of people feel that footballers themselves are paid very, very high salaries for what they do. On a minute-by-minute basis, even if you include their training, they are paid a horrendous amount of money. But then that's the path that they choose to go down. But when you go down a risky path like that, you've got to accept that sometimes you'll fall. I don't like to look at these matters. Going on to the fact that he said that he'll resign if he doesn't get planning permission, if they don't get their new stadium.
I think he's just hinted at the fact that he might. Yeah.
Well, perhaps he's been misrepresented, but I would hope he had. But I also would say I think it would be a dreadful shame if this city, and it's a good city, and it's a big city, it's number 8 in the country, doesn't get a jolly good stadium. That's what we need.
We've got 2 football clubs, haven't we? Maybe that's too many.
Well, perhaps you'd like to go along to the next Rovers match and suggest that. I'd like to be a fly on the wall when you do.
Most major cities have 2 football teams. It's standard.
So what's your view on the stadium? Because there's a lot of issues there. A lot of the local people living in around Southville are not happy about having a big supermarket built where the stadium is currently at Ashton Gate. And also a lot of the residents at Ashton Vale, just outside, are rather concerned that their nice rural environment will be turned into a kind of megalopolis by this giant stadium descending on their back gardens.
Well, you're never going to please everybody. Whatever happens, whenever you take a major decision, you're going to have people who think it was brilliant and you're going to have people who think you should be shot. And that's a risk you take when you're a politician. My own view is that I think it was a good proposal. I wasn't on the planning committee, but had I been, I would have been voted in favour of the move of the store there, because having been in retail myself, I know that some of the objections that were raised by small retailers, in actual fact, were totally erroneous, and that a large store close to them will actually bring people in who will also go to their businesses. I was in a business which competed in a small way with B&Q, and I would have loved them to have built a B&Q next door to me. I would have paid money for it. So I think that some of the arguments that were presented were not really fair or true.
Now, it was a House of Commons exchange on Tuesday last week that catapulted housing benefits into the spotlight. Friday Drive Time's Marina Morris has been out and about on the streets of Bristol this week to find out what you think of the Condem Coalition's plans to put a cap on housing benefit.
Is the proposed housing benefit cap fair?
I'm looking for a job at the moment myself. Fortunately, I've not had to go and rely on the system yet. There are some people who basically could get turfed out of their houses, and I think, I mean, certainly for young families, that could be quite upsetting, you know, quite disturbing for sort of family life. I think they should keep the system as it is. I obviously realise that there's a lot of cost cutting that needs to be done, but it's, you know, something that should be there. Most of us have actually paid into this system, should be able to sort of, like, you know, take it back out. People should live where they live, basically, and be happy and not have to worry about these sorts of cuts. No, it's not fair. I mean, really, because, I mean, we've got this ever-growing gap. The gap between rich and poor has just been steadily growing larger and larger since 1997. And it just seems that there's more of a gap now there ever has been. And it seems there's nothing there evening it out.
Well, I think it's a difficult argument because housing benefits obviously, like, if you've got children and stuff like that, then it's fair enough. Like, it must be hard to, like, I'm working and stuff, and I find it hard to have enough money for myself, let alone if I was to think about having for other people. I'd have to make a lot of sacrifices. But at the same time, I don't know, the government's got to make cuts. I'm at university now, and they're making cuts about university fees. They're increasing them, which is pretty annoying, but it won't affect me, but I still feel bad for the people who it will affect. So yeah, any cuts are going to be bad, but if the housing benefit is in place because sort of the people who are claiming it can't work, then that's fair enough. But if you're born into money, then that's very fortunate. But if you're not, then obviously you're very unlucky. And again, if you've got children, then that obviously makes a big difference.
I feel that a lot of people are receiving benefit that could find work, and a lot of people won't work because they feel they're better off receiving benefit than actually working. I worked for 44 years before I retired, and I didn't claim benefit, fortunately, but I feel that, yes, the very poorest should receive it, but they should be encouraged to work.
If people have been given housing benefits and then are able to earn the money to possibly rent themselves, then they should obviously be able to not have those benefits and move on. So in that respect, I think the cap is probably a good thing. My understanding, at least the way they're saying it, is that the benefits aren't being cut from the poorest, and that there is a pot of money or something that will help them. But I think what they're looking at is obviously, you know, the cap on people that probably can afford to possibly pay more at this current time should be paying more.
Because they're at the bottom of the heap anyway, it's almost immoral pushing them further down.
It is going to affect a lot of people, especially from my point of view, from older people. They need it to live on or to help them work their budgets out. It really is bad. There is just not enough accommodation for people. So, and that's going to increase. Give it a year or so, it's going to be a really horrendous problem in Bristol. A lot of people depend on their housing benefits to pay their rent. And if that's cut off, that number's going to go up terrifically. So I think it could go up by half.
Now, that was Marina Morris's Vox Pop this week, talking about housing benefits with people on the streets of Bristol. Chris, how can you justify a Conservative LibCon cap on housing benefits when it's actually quite likely to render so many people homeless, as we were hearing there? Some people are very, very concerned about this, that actually it's hitting the poorest in society the hardest.
Yeah, I have sympathy with those people that are going to be hit, but you have to face facts, and that is that this country is in a powerless state financially, that if something isn't done to save large amounts of money very, very quickly, then we take the risk of becoming bankrupt as a country. If that happens, everybody will suffer dreadfully, but the people that we're talking about that have housing benefit will be the people that will suffer most, and I just believe it's a lesser of two evils.
Martin?
Yeah, I think underlying all of this is the lack of affordable housing for people on low incomes. We've not built any proper social housing. We've just been remiss on that for a generation. All governments have failed to do their job in relation to this. Once we had selling off of council housing in the 1980s, we've not actually provided enough housing for people. And it was actually a Conservative government in the 1950s that built the most council houses, Macmillan.
Well, 3 weeks ago on this show, Liberal Democrat councillor for Ashley Ward, Shirley Brown, discussed charges against her for racially aggravated harassment. So let's have a little listen back to that, and then we'll have some comments from Chris and Martin after.
Shirley was also in the headlines, ironically perhaps for a meeting she did attend, when she accused Tory councillor Jay Jethwa, who is Asian, of being a coconut. An insult intended to imply that a person of colour is betraying their interests of their ethnic group by supporting the interests of white people. In other words, being brown on the outside and white on the inside. Councillor Jethwa had voted in favour of a Tory motion to cut funding from the Legacy Commission, which supports ethnic minority groups as part of the celebrations marking the 200th anniversary of the end of the slave trade. Councillor Brown retorted, "In our culture, we have a word for you, a word which many in our city would understand, and that's coconut. At the end of the day, I look at you as that." Despite an apology, Shirley was suspended from the council in July for 4 weeks by the Standards Committee, but this was overturned on appeal. An internal council investigation found that although the language used was, quote, deeply offensive, it was not considered racist. Councillor Brown was not so fortunate in court, however, where she was convicted of racially aggravated harassment and given a 12-month conditional discharge and a criminal record. She is currently appealing the judgment and, because the sentence is less than 3 months, is entitled to continue in her post as councillor.
Now, I understand that your appeal is pending and you were due to actually have a hearing, yes, which has again been put off. Now, yes. Does you think this actually affects your ability to do the case when you're expecting to have a hearing and then you're suddenly told, no, it's not going to be today, it's going to be another several weeks' time?
This whole process has been absolutely terrible. The whole thing, I've never had a criminal record. I've lived a life to be a mentor, to be an example, to make a difference in my community. I've worked tirelessly, endlessly with young people, with people from different ethnic groups, different communities. I have worked very, very hard. And being the only African Caribbean counsellor as well, there's a lot of people within the community do look up to me as a mentor.
That's Shirley Brown there speaking 3 weeks ago on this programme. Now, Chris, Conservative councillor, do you support this prosecution of Shirley, which is still ongoing, actually, for racially aggravated harassment? Because it seems a bit strange. How can it be racially motivated since Shirley is an Afro-Caribbean herself?
I think I'm in a bit of difficulty here because the case is coming up, I believe, if I'm right, on the 20th of December as an appeal at the Crown Court, and I feel that I can't comment on a case that it could be considered sub judice at the moment. It would be wrong of me to comment on the case, so I'm not prepared to do that at this point.
But however, just on the point of whether one person of colour could call another one a coconut, and that could be racially motivated.
Well, I think that we've got to let the courts take their decision on that, and I wouldn't want to try and preempt their decision. I'm quite happy to come back on your show and talk after a decision has been made either way.
OK, Chris, thanks very much. Well, thank you to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. After the news, who are the Tea Party? We discuss this week's US elections, as well as hearing calls for a radical shake-up of the banking system by a new city regulator from the Bank of England, Mervyn King. And we talk home education after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol